Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Theology Matters, folks. I'm your host, Devin Palou, and really excited to be back. Haven't done a radio show for a little while. Been out for a few months, but glad to be back and have some really exciting shows coming up here in the future. We'll talk about here in a bit, but today we're going to be interviewing Miss Nancy Piercy on her new book, Love Thy Body, and been really excited to get her on to talk about this book. I think it's really, really important, and I think will definitely be very beneficial and just another great tool in many tools that she has given us. And so we're going to dive a little bit into that. If you've not liked us on Facebook, you can go to Theology Matters with the Palous. And on that Facebook page, you'll see a lot of the shows that we've done. We've hosted a lot of discussions and dialogues. We've had atheists and pro-choice people on to debate some of these important issues, as well as several of the folks from the Discovery Institute and look at intelligent design. So if you've not liked our show, be sure, or our page, be sure to do that, and you'll get a list of our podcasts and older shows that we've done. So that being said, let me go ahead and introduce kind of this episode of Theology Matters. We're going to be talking to the best-selling author and professor Nancy Piercy. We're going to be discussing again her book Love Thy Body, answering hard questions about life and sexuality. In this book, Ms. Piercy fearlessly and with compassion makes the case that secularism denigrates the body and destroys the basis for human rights. Throughout, Piercy sets forth a holistic and humane alternative available to all, one that offers authentic, reality-oriented solutions that embrace the dignity of the human body and provide a sustainable basis for unalienable human rights. Ms. Piercy has been a visiting scholar at Biola University's Torrey Honors Institute, professor of worldview studies at Cairn University, and Francis A. Schaeffer scholar at the World Journalism Institute. Currently, she's a professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University, and a fellow at the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, and editor-at-large of the Piercy Report. Ms. Piercy, are you there?
I sure am. Ready to go.
Well, I appreciate you you coming on and joining us to talk about your new book. For those maybe who are not familiar with some of your other works, probably one of the most popular works you have done was Total Truth, and maybe you want to take a minute or so just to talk about that and what exactly is in there.
Yeah, well, Love Thy Body builds on Total Truth, and so I'm glad you're starting there. Total Truth deals with the breakup in the concept of truth itself. And Francis Schaeffer was the first person to sort of sound the alarm on this in evangelical circles. And he pointed out that people used to have a comprehensive view of truth. They knew that there were natural truths and there were moral truths. And they thought that they were integrated into one total system. With the rise of modern science, many people began to think that the only reliable knowledge is empirical facts, what's scientifically knowable. Well, what happens then to things like moral truths, or theological truths? Well, they decided those are not really truths at all because they can't be stuffed into a test tube or studied under a microscope. So they're not really truths after all. They're just private subjective values. Those are your personal preferences. So Schaeffer used the image of two stories in a building where the lower story became empirically knowable truths, what's rational, what's objective, and the upper story became defined as the area of personal preference and personal values. In the secular world, this was called the fact-value split. Schaeffer didn't use that term, but when I discovered that the secular world understood the same thing, they just had a they just had a name for it. They called it the fact value split. And then I wrote Total Truth to help Christians understand that this is the mindset. It's the grid. Or as my students say, this is the matrix. This is where people, the framework in which people think, and they don't know they think this. So that if you try to communicate a Christian view, they immediately, without even thinking about it, put it in the upper story where they hear it as you making a statement about your personal faith, your personal beliefs, what makes you feel better. And that's why they can say, well, that may be true for you, but not true for me. Because they have the split view of truth where they've decided that theological truths are not really truth. And they don't even hear you making an objective truth claim.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I do work on the college campus and kind of give that some kind of analogy. And I would ask, you know, how far is the sun from the earth? You know, is it just, you know, can we know for certain? You know, is it 93 million miles away? Is that true for me? And somebody else says, well, it's only 6 million miles away. We just wouldn't think like that, right? We would say, no, there's an objective way to test that. But, you know, you're so right. When it comes to the religious truths, it just seems like those are kind of personal preference or up for grab.
Exactly. And that's why you can hear people say, well, that could be true for you, but not true for me. They would never say that in terms of facts. Here's another way of thinking about it. We often hear people say, don't impose your values on me. But we never hear people say, don't impose your facts on me. Because, you know, values are considered personal preference. Facts are considered objective and true. That's that split view of truth at work.
Man, that's such a great analogy, and you know, we really do see it. And then the other book you did, Finding Truth. I think I've had you on the podcast before. We talked a little bit about that book, but maybe for those who didn't hear the podcast, tell us a little bit about Finding Truth.
Yeah, I'm really excited about Finding Truth because it gives us a way to test any and all truth claims. I don't know about you, Devin, but you probably read a lot of books on apologetics and philosophy and worldview, and I sometimes find it overwhelming. I feel like, well, you know, this argument applies to that view, and this argument applies to that view, and this argument applies to another view. And I think, how am I going to remember all that? There is no way I can master and remember all of these arguments and have them at my fingertips when I'm talking to a real person. Well, Finding Truth gives one simple, systematic way, strategy of answering all the isms. And it's, what's really exciting is it's based on Romans 1. So we can, it's not something any person invented. It's from Scripture. It's from God's Word. And it's in Romans 1, Paul says, if you don't acknowledge the transcendent creator, you will end up making a god, an idol, out of something in the created world. Right? They exchange the truth of God for something in the created world. And we don't, you know, obviously idols are not just golden calves, statues. An idol can be an intellectual concept as well. So take, for example, materialism, modern materialism, which is rampant on the secular campus today. It says, what is the ultimate reality? Where does everything come from? Matter. Well, so matter is, in a sense, functioning as its God, as the ultimate reality, as the uncaused cause of everything else. So matter is its idol. So it functions as an idol in the biblical sense because it takes the place of God. And you can do that with every religion and every philosophy. You can say, okay, if they don't acknowledge its transcendent creator, there will be something within the cosmos that it will have to choose as its ultimate. And then I go on to show why I go on to show how that will always be ineffective. It will always be inadequate. Why? Because if you take part of creation, it's always a part, and a part cannot explain the whole. And so once you get the strategy down, you can take any ism and show it's not enough to explain. Well, take materialism, since we already mentioned that. Materialism will never be enough to explain the human person because it says it has to deny everything about you that's not material. It has to reduce people to complex biochemical machines. And so it says free will, it's an illusion. Love, meaning, and even consciousness, that's the issue today, sort of on the front lines, is what is consciousness? Well, there are philosophers saying it's an illusion. So they have to deny everything about the human being that's not reducible to matter. And so as a result, it will never be big enough, so to speak, to explain all of human reality. And you can do that with every ism out there. You can show why it has to choose something in the created order as its God, and then it will never be big enough to explain all of human experience. And what's philosophy supposed to do, after all, is to explain reality as we experience it. So that's what Finding Truth does.
Right.
It's a great equipper for anyone who's trying to make sense of secular and religious worldviews.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal book, and you guys can go back on our podcast and listen to that. I think we did almost a two-hour episode on that book, so be sure to Google Theology Matters, Nancy Piercy, and that work should come up as well. So tell us a little bit about the new book. I figured we could spend a little time and just delve into the chapters, but what would you say kind of as an overview of, I guess, would suppose this is your newest work, Love Thy Body?
Yeah, it takes that split view of truth that I analyze in Finding in Total Truth. In Total Truth, I show that there's a split view of truth. Well, if you have a split view of truth, it's going to affect everything, including a view of the human person. And so what I show is that in secular thought today, there is a split view of the human person. It's often called the body-person dualism. And let me unpack it. Sometimes it's easier to show than to tell. I'll unpack it in terms of abortion because that's the easiest place to see it. Today, there are no bioethicists who deny that life begins at conception. Ordinary people might sometimes quibble about this, but professional bioethicists, because of the advances in genetics and DNA, none of them deny that the human life begins at conception. But what they'll argue then is that the fetus is human from conception, but it's not a person. To become a person, you have to have a prescribed level of self-awareness, self-determination, cognitive ability, and so on. So in essence, what are they saying? They're saying that being human gives you no moral standing, gives you no legal protection, that being human is not enough to have human rights. Until it becomes a person, it's really just a disposable piece of matter. It can be killed for any reason or no reason. It can be used for research. It can be tinkered with genetically, harvested for organs, and then disposed of with the other medical waste. And this is actually called personhood theory. And you can see how it's an outworking of that fact-value split. If you think of the two-story metaphor, to be biologically human is a scientific fact. That's in the lower story. But to be a person is an ethical concept, and that's defined by what we value. So it's in the upper story, and it's completely relativistic. Every bioethicist draws the line at a different place because there's really no scientific definition of personhood. I mean, think of it this way. If you were to change from a piece of matter to a person with inviolable rights to life is a momentous change. But there's no transformative point that science can detect objectively. So the definition of personhood is purely subjective, arbitrary, private, just like all the other personal values.
And it's amazing how many Christians tend to think like this as well. I talk to them all the time where they almost have the same, I think you give the, what Francis Schaeffer with the two stories. And, you know, I thought like that for a long time before I was a Christian. It's almost like you're trained to think like that. There's these, you know, difference between religious truths and ethical truths or these other type of truths that you're talking about. So I guess that, I mean, you seem to tackle it in chapter one. It's titled, I Hate Me, The Rise and Decline of the Human Body. Maybe we can start there, and I'll just kind of let you unpack a little bit in the chapter.
Right. Well, that chapter goes, it's kind of a survey chapter, because I found that the best way to explain the body-person dualism is through examples. And so that first chapter goes through virtually all the major issues. So after using abortion, for example, I go on to euthanasia and assisted suicide. And like you, I have run into a lot of Christians who have questions about this. And I say, well, think of it as the abortion argument in reverse. If bioethicists are defending abortion by saying anyone who has not achieved a certain level of cognitive awareness is not really a person, then they defend euthanasia by saying if you lose certain cognitive abilities, you're no longer a person, even though you're obviously still human. And at that point, you can be unplugged, your treatment can be withheld, your food and water can be discontinued, your organs can be harvested. So once again, you see, being biologically human is not enough to qualify for human rights. You have to earn the right to legal protection by exercising an arbitrary level of cortical functioning. And people try to sell this to the public as compassionate. Well, that's not compassionate. It's exclusive. It's saying some people don't measure up. They don't make the cut. They don't qualify for personhood. And interestingly enough, it's really the pro-life position that's inclusive. It says if you're a member of the human race, you're in. You have the dignity and status of personhood. You are a full member of the moral community. So I was once invited to be on an NPR program in San Francisco, and they quizzed me ahead of time. The producer quizzed me on my question. And when I told him that, he called back later and said I had been disinvited from the show. So I think what's happening is I use the liberal buzzwords, exclusive and inclusive, and they didn't really know how to handle the fact that it's their view, really, that's exclusive.
Right. Yeah, and I think just the general public, when they hear these arguments like, well, it's biologically a human, but it's not a person. I think the general public just they don't know. I think a lot of Christians don't know what to do with that, how to respond to that. How do you engage with that when you hear those kind of arguments are made? How does the Christian respond to that?
Well, it gives us a chance to craft our arguments in a very positive way. In other words, we come across sometimes as negative or judgmental, angry, or don't do it, it's a sin, it's wrong, thou shalt not. But recognizing this body-person dichotomy helps us to be able to craft an argument that actually we're trying to help people have a higher view of human life. We're the ones who are saying there is value in dignity, in just being human,
yeah,
quote unquote, just. You know, that it really goes back ultimately to your view of the cosmos itself. What is your view of the cosmos? Do you say that life is a product of blind material forces, and that human life, therefore, has no intrinsic meaning or purpose? In which case, it's up to us. It's up to us then to decide what value and meaning life has. And on the one hand, that can sound very liberating because it means we make up our own rules. On the other hand, what it means is that objectively speaking, life has no meaning. It is insignificant in the literal sense of signifying nothing. And it's the Christian view that says, no, we see the cosmos as teleological, to use a technical term. Teleological just means purpose-driven. It has a purpose. It was created by a loving creator, and it has meaning and purpose, And being human does not just mean you're a piece of matter. Being human means you're made in the image of God and have great dignity, value, and significance. And so we are coming to people with a positive message that life has a higher meaning and dignity than they realize, and that we're not coming at them to condemn them, but we're coming at them to encourage them to adopt this much higher, more beautiful, more appealing, more attractive worldview.
Yeah, page 21 of your book, you kind of flesh that out as you're saying. You have a quote that says, Christianity holds that body and soul together from an integrated unity, that the human being is an embodied soul. By contrast, personhood theory entails a two-level dualism that sets body against the person, as though they were two separate things merely stuck together. As a result, it demeans the body as extrinsic to the person, something inferior that can be used for purely pragmatic purposes. And that's, I love how you're able to contrast that. I guess a lot of it does get back to the worldview issues. The March for Life, I believe that started today. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it seems like maybe more Christians are starting to realize, maybe non-Christians too, starting maybe to realize that there is more, you know, intrinsic value to life. I've heard that the popular percentages has kind of started to swing in favor of the pro-life position. Have you heard that, or would you know about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's in Love Thy Body. It's I give the statistics there, but the millennials are far more pro-life than their baby boomer parents. And it's fascinating. It's partly because, of course, of ultrasound. They've been able to see the baby in the womb. The baby is no longer, no longer just invisible. And
right.
They've come to see it more as a human rights issue. And of course, they've seen the products of neonatal medicine, where we can keep babies alive at smaller and earlier and earlier ages, so that where I just saw a news article by a woman whose child was born at less than 2 pounds. You know, these babies, they're smaller than babies that are being aborted down the street at the abortion center. And
wow.
Young people are aware of that. They're scientifically educated enough to know that the babies being aborted are babies that are viable, that could survive, and that they've seen them born, they've seen them thrive. They no longer have can kind of shut their eyes to the reality of the humanity of the fetus. And again, you know, it's back to that humanity versus personhood. They realize that we know historically what happens when certain groups are denied personhood. We've seen it, well, most dramatically in the 20th century with the Holocaust and with communism. The Holocaust decided that certain groups were not fully human. You know, Jews, Slavs, Gypsies, and others were not fully human. They knew they were human, but they denied them personhood. That's the distinction.
Right.
They denied them legal personhood. And the same with the Soviet Union. We've seen what happens when groups are denied are labeled as sub-persons or non-persons. That's the terminology used even today by bioethicists. They will say the fetus is a human but is a non-person. So now we have this strange creature that's human but non-person, which sounds counterintuitive, because in the past we've always thought a human is a person, and the Christian still thinks that. But the non-Christian today says, no, you can be a human non-person. But we've seen the consequences of that, and we know that it always leads to some group being suppressed, exploited, and ultimately eliminated. We know that it leads to inhumanity and tyranny.
Yeah, I love, you know, to your point with the younger generation seeming to be more pro-life. you know, the reasons you outline, it's like really because our science has gotten better and kind of shown life does begin at conception, and kind of really it's the science that leads us to that conclusion about protecting life and life beginning at conception. It just seems, with the whole personhood thing, it just seems almost like an escape hatch to try and to still have the abortion, but you're not able to have that grounding in biology anymore. How would you answer that objection when they're saying it's a human but not a person?
Well, I like the direction you were taking that, and that is that today it's Christians who are holding up the value of science and biology, that if you're biologically human, that counts. We have a higher view of biology. You see, essentially what they're saying is as long as a fetus is just a body and not a person, it can be killed for any reason. Well, we're saying no, if you're a body, if you're biologically human, that should be enough to count. It's Christians who are saying it's the scientific facts are what count, and not just with this subject. Obviously, yeah. With questions of homosexuality, transgenderism, and so on, all across the board, which is why I cover all of these topics in Love Thy Body, is because they are all dealing with a fragmented view of the person that says your body doesn't matter or your biology is not part of your true identity. The authentic self has nothing to do with who you are biologically. All of them denigrate the body and biology. And so this is surprising, I think, for many people because they think of Christianity as something that denigrates the body. I read an article not too long ago that said pro-lifers are just against women having a healthy, happy sex life. Well, no, it turns out it's Christians now who are saying, we are the ones with a high view of the body and a high view of biology and a high view of science, and we really need to turn the tables when we have discussions with people on this. The shoe is on the other foot now, and we need to take advantage of that when we have discussions with our friends and our family members who are still asking questions about these things.
I love that because it's kind of touted in it's kind of the media that it's the Christians that are anti-science and, you know, anti-thinking. But more and more, especially with Christian academics, you're seeing they're the ones that are going to biology and trying to chain their argument to biology. And it's the other side that is not wanting to do that. It's almost like they're trying to get away from the hard sciences. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, they're becoming postmodern.
Oh, go ahead. Yep.
And no, I just said they're becoming postmodern, and that's why we need to understand postmodernism. There was a little anecdote that I tell in Love Thy Body it started when a deconstructionist postmodern professor named Stanley Fish wrote an article. And he said pro-lifers have no right to bring their views into the public arena because their views are not based on science but on faith. And Robert George of Princeton challenged Fish to a debate at a meeting of the American Political Science Association. And in his paper, he argued that in reality, it's the pro-life position that's based on science. After all, nobody asks about the moral worth of human life until we first establish that human life exists. And so the pro-life argument starts with the scientific data. And it's customary for the two scholars to exchange their papers ahead of time. So when the meeting opened, Stanley Fish threw Robert George's paper on the table and announced, "Professor George is right, and he is right to correct me." Which was the admission was met by a stunned silence, and Stanley Fish did have the to his credit, he wrote an article later explaining, and what he meant was, you know, up until now, the supporters of abortion have cast themselves as the defenders of science and rationality against the forces of ignorance and superstition, and which means religion, of course, but science is actually on the pro-life side now because it keeps pushing back the moment when life begins. And he says, as a result, abortion supporters have shifted tactics. They now are the ones who are rejecting science and have shifted to this concept of personhood, which is non-scientific, non-empirical, cannot be detected objectively. You know, it's defined differently by every bioethicist out there, and and it's essentially a postmodern concept. And so I don't know that Christians have quite picked up on this and are really using it, but it's really in our favor to show that that the other side has shifted tactics, like you said. The shifted tactics need no longer appeal to science. And in fact, you in Love Thy Body, I give some examples of abortion supporters saying, oh, well, who cares about the science? Who cares about the science? We need to move beyond science. We need to start just arguing for women's rights. Or, you know, we need to start arguing that the Declaration of Independence is wrong. Not all life is equal. The mother's life, you know, takes precedence over the baby's life. And so, in other words, they are consciously starting to say we need to move beyond the scientific facts.
Oh, that's good. Good stuff. Folks, we're going to take a quick tune-up break or so. If you would like to, are you okay to answer a few questions if people wanted to call Ms. Piercy? Or?
Sure, that would be great.
Yeah, the number is 760-542-3907. That's 760-542-3907. If you have a question, it's not every day you get to talk to Ms. Piercy, so it'd be good to have you call in if you have questions, and we come back, we will look at chapter 2 in her book, Love Thy Body. So stay with us.
You're listening to the Ankerberg Minute with apologist and best-selling author Dr. John Ankerberg.
How can we know that God exists? Well, there are many arguments for the existence of God, but one of the most popular is known as the moral argument. The moral argument shares that every law needs a lawgiver, a personal being who is the source of our innate sense of right and wrong. Since moral laws do exist, such as not lying, stealing, or not to murder, there must be an original source for these morals. The Bible explains that God alone is holy, righteous, and morally perfect, and exactly fits the description of this moral lawgiver. As Paul said, God's righteousness endures forever. God alone is holy and serves as our source of perfection and standard of guidance for life.
For additional resources on this topic, log on to johnankerberg.org.
My name is Scott Klusendorf. I'm the president of Life Training Institute, and I'm a guest lecturer in bioethics at Biola University. The case for life was written to express to the believer in Jesus Christ that he or she can make a defense for what they believe on the pro-life issue without offending people, by being gracious, and yet at the same time bringing solid logic and argumentation to the debate so that unbelievers look at the Christian at that point and go, wow, Christianity has something relevant to say on a crucial moral issue of our day. Maybe, just maybe, it has something relevant to say on other big issues as well. Because once you start talking about the ultimate questions, like do humans have value for what they are or what they can do? Is truth real and knowable, or is it just a preference like choosing ice cream? Once you bring those questions to the table, it's a real short journey over to the other questions over here, which have to do with how do we get right with our Maker? How do I, as an individual, get my life in line with the creator of the universe? It's a nice bridge right into talking to people on evangelistic topics.
Nancy, thanks for a great presentation tonight. It was excellent. As you're going through it, I thought a question that atheists might ask, and it's kind of similar to the very first question that was asked, just pushing it a bit further. If a materialist asked you, why should I believe what you are calling general revelation is true rather than my materialism based on science, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, it's all about what is the purpose of a worldview or philosophy. Is the purpose of a philosophy to create castles in the air, nice little systems that hang up in the abstract realm, or is it to explain the real world? If it's to explain the real world, then it has to fit the real world. You know, that's why we go to general revelation, which is, you know, their own. And notice I kept stressing their own experience doesn't fit their worldview. It's not like I'm telling them, I disagree with you. We're pointing out that you yourself say that when you take your, like Steven Pinker, you take your lab coat off and you go home and you switch to a completely different paradigm. So it has to do with what is the purpose of a worldview. Most people want a worldview not for some abstract little logically coherent system. Yeah, like I kept saying, the reductionist view is very logically consistent. If you start with natural causes alone, we will end up as being complex machines. That's logically consistent, but it's hanging up here in the abstract realm, doesn't fit the real world of even those who profess it. So I would press them to the question of why are we discussing philosophy? We want a philosophy that explains how you and I actually have to live in this world.
All right, folks, and we are back with Ms. Nancy Piercy, and you got to hear her in action a little bit there. And just so happy to have her join us. We're talking about her new book, Love Thy Body, and just a fascinating work, just full of great research and very thought-provoking work for sure. In chapter two, it's called the joy. Let's see, get the full thing here. The joy of death. You must be prepared to kill. Maybe you could talk a little bit about chapter two, and when you get a minute, if you could talk a little bit about Peter Singer, maybe for those who don't know who he is, and just some of the stuff you have there.
Yeah, well, you know, we have actually covered much of chapter two because it then zeroes in on abortion. In other words, chapter one is an overview. And then chapter two starts with my first real issue, which is abortion. But Peter Singer would be a good example of someone who adopts personhood theory. And what he says is from conception you are a human organism, as he puts it, but you are not a person. And a person has to have some level of self-awareness. He has a list of different qualities that you have to have if you're going to qualify as a person. But of course, his list differs from every other bioethicist out there. So again, like we were saying before the break, personhood is a postmodern concept. It's very relativistic. And that applies, by the way, that's chapter three is euthanasia, which we've also touched on already as well. As soon as you make a distinction between a person and a human and a person, you're making invidious distinctions that, you know, historically we know that various groups have, once they're considered subpersonal, then they're considered ripe for exploitation and even, you know, putting them in concentration camps and killing them. So I think that people need to realize that this is not just an academic discussion of terms, but that it has real world consequences.
Wow, that's good. I think you're right. Real world consequences for real life people. That's good. Well, let's maybe look at number four, schizoid sex hijacked by the hookup culture. Talk a little bit about this chapter for us, if you would.
Right. So here I am trying to show that this body person division is what underlies all of the issues, the secular ethic in every area. And so think about the hookup culture and how it denigrates the body. The rules of the game of the hookup culture, as every college student knows, the rules of the game are no love, no relationship, no commitment. You're supposed to be able to walk away from it as if it never happened. Or as one person was quoted in, A young student named Naomi was quoted in Rolling Stone magazine saying, she said, I think the mistake people make is they think that you can divide a person in half, that you can say, I have an emotional relationship on the one hand, and that the physical relationship is completely separate. And as she put it, and there are clean lines between them. So you can almost imagine Schaefer's upper and lower story here with clean lines between them. People think they can be purely physically involved and not involved as a whole person. Well, some people think, well, this kind of hedonism, doesn't that give sex too much importance? And I would say, no, it gives sex too little importance. Another quote, this is in Rolling Stone as well. A young man told Rolling Stone magazine, sex is just one piece of body touching another piece of body. It is existentially meaningless. So what we're seeing here is that people are trying to live out that two-story dualism, dichotomy, the two-story split in terms of their behavior. They're trying to say, I think I can be physically involved and not emotionally involved. In Love Thy Body, I found several quotes from college students saying, to be in the hookup culture, you have to respond just physically and turn yourself off emotionally. Or they'll say, we get physically involved without being emotionally involved. And yet at the same time, they don't really like this. There's a researcher named Donna Freitas who interviewed hundreds of college students. And on the one hand, they would say, oh, yes, the hookup culture is wonderful. It's liberating. It's fun. It's exciting. And then as she spent more time with them, they began to privately admit that they find their meaningless sexual encounters very disappointing, that they feel hurt and lonely, and that they wish they knew how to create a genuine relationship in which they're known and loved as whole persons. And so if to dig deeper, once again, where is this coming from? It's coming from a materialist view of the human being as a physical organism driven by sheer physical drives with no higher purpose. And no wonder it's leaving a trail of wounded people. They're trying to live out a worldview that does not fit who they really are.
Wow. It's just, because you see it all the time, especially, if you work with college students, and it really is kind of pointing them to that whole person, really, that Christian worldview. It's just such a dreary view, just the naturalistic view. It just does not offer hope at all. You have a section on page 125, porn versus intimacy. I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that for a second as well, because I know that you had some statistics that were pretty frightening as far as even Christians that are involved with porn.
Yeah, that's right. At the beginning of the book, I have some statistics on the sheer number of people who are involved in pornography, including Christians. Yes, I was surprised as well. I was surprised at how deeply the problem has infiltrated the Christian church as well. Yeah, and obviously pornography is perhaps the most obvious example of this body-person divide, because in pornography, you're trying to respond to somebody's body without any connection to who they are as a person. And if you're totally depersonalizing the person who's being presented to you on the computer screen or the image, whatever. So, and you realize the next step is sex robots. There are actually a couple of brothels now in Europe that are sex robot brothels, and I've seen the news items on them. And prepare yourself. This is the worst. There are sex robots now of children for pedophiles.
Oh.
And there was an article not long ago. I put it on my Facebook page if you want to look it up. On child sex robots. And fortunately, some countries are now passing laws outlawing them and not allowing them into their country. And one of our members of Congress is also introducing a bill so that we will have a law against it as well. But what we're seeing, of course, is people who are being programmed to treat women as just a body with no personal interaction at all. So if you want the extreme version of this body-person divide, that's what pornography is. And to train your brain to react to that kind of depersonalization, it's not a harmless recreation. Barna, the researcher George Barna, found that even among Christians, millennials treat porn as no big deal. They don't realize how deeply it is training them to objectify women and is bleeding into their personal relationships. They're not able, when they do get married or do have a serious relationship, they're finding that they're not able to respond to real women. They've been so used to responding to this depersonalized image that they no longer can respond in a loving relationship to a real person. So it's destroying relationships.
Wow. Maybe for those listening who may have friends or family members that are caught up in that, how does the Christian respond to this? How do we help our friends or family work through this, who may be, in this?
Well, certainly there are good organizations out there that deal with it, because it is a kind of addiction. When you see pornography, your brain is flooded by dopamine and other chemicals. And that's where you get that sense of high, just like you do with alcohol, drugs, and so on. It is very, very similar. And it actually begins to reprogram your brain, chemically speaking.
Wow.
And when your brain is flooded by a chemical like that, dopamine, it eventually starts shutting down the receptors because it's too much dopamine. That's why you're getting a high, because it's actually too much, more than your body needs. And therefore, it begins shutting down those receptors, which means you don't get as much of a high next time. So eventually you have to go to ever more hardcore porn in order to get the same high. And that's how it becomes an addiction. It is literally like a drug addiction, because your body is responding to the dopamine in your brain. So that's why it's so dangerous. I mean, we now know that porn is not only addictive, but it feeds into sexual violence against women. It destroys relationships. It feeds into sexual trafficking and prostitution. There's an organization that is addressing specifically young people. It's called Fight the New Drug. And their slogan is "Porn kills love." Porn kills love. So they're helping.
Wow.
They're trying to reach millennials with the message that porn is a lot more devastating than many people think. It really is very damaging to you as a person.
That's good. And that, again, folks, that's chapter 4 in this book. So very very good stuff. Chapter 5, you have the body. Impolitic, how the homosexual narrative demeans the body. And I know this, would cause a lot of anger in today's type of culture but I'll let you kind of flesh that out for us.
Right. Yes. Once again, if we get a better handle on it, this is one of those issues where even in the church, young people are not sure why homosexuality is wrong. I teach at a Christian college, and my colleagues tell me that at least that more than half of the students do not have a biblical view of homosexuality. So that's why this is so important, to help them to understand, well, what's behind the biblical view? Not just is it wrong, but why is it wrong? And once again, think of it this way. It's the body-person divide again. No one really denies that biologically, physiologically, anatomically, males and females are counterparts to one another. That's how this human sexual and reproductive system is designed. So when you embrace a same-sex identity, implicitly you're contradicting that design. You are saying, why should the structure of my body inform my identity? Why should my biological sex, as male or female, have any say in my moral choices, in where I direct my sexual desires? This is a profoundly disrespectful view of the body. The implication is that what counts is not whether I'm biologically male or female, but solely my mind, feelings, desires, and so on. You see, that's kind of the upper lower story split we were talking about earlier. In the lower story, okay, fine, I'm biologically male or female. But in the upper story, I can decide what I want to be. I can decide to accept, you know, I can deny the natural connection between between biological sex and sexual desire. So it's a body-person split again, and so it has a fragmenting and self-alienating effect on the human personality. So those who are defending a biblical view of sexuality are not relying on a few scattered Bible verses, you know, which are of interest maybe only if you're a very literalist person. That's how many of my students think. Instead, if you have a biblical view of sexuality, what you are doing is you're accepting a teleological worldview. Teleological, again, means purpose-driven, where the structure of the universe, including our bodies, reflects a divine purpose. And as a result, the biblical ethic heals that inner split. It heals the self-alienation. It leads to a holistic integration of personality. It encourages people to live in harmony with their bodies. And even postmodern gender theorists, Judith Butler is sort of the guru of queer theory. And even she talks about a mismatch between our physical sex and our sexual desire. And she basically says, well, we just have to give up the notion that we should have any sort of internal harmony, internal integration. We just have to give up the notion that there's a natural connection between your biological sex and your sexual desire, because there are people, she herself is a lesbian, says she does not have the internal integration, and she calls it denaturalizing. We have to denaturalize the very idea of sexual orientation and say that there is no natural connection, and we all have to accept the notion that we're fragmented bits and pieces that are disconnected and that there's no internal coherence. Well, you can see why the Christian view is actually much more humane, because we're saying, no, you're not just scattered bits and pieces. It is good to have an internal coherence. That is how God created us.
Yeah, and it seems, again, it goes back to the almost trying to get away from the science, trying to get away from biology. And I know this leads into chapter 6 and probably a lot of the same points are going to apply, but with the transgender and, what's the... In that particular chapter, I guess it's the same kind of points you're going to stick. Maybe walk us through the chapter with the transgenderism. It just seems to have really just blown up as far as acceptance and popularity. It just seems to be like the next thing now that same-sex marriage is legal and that's kind of been accepted. Now it seems like transgenderism is kind of the next thing up.
Right, and it's even easier to detect the dualism, the body-person split in arguments that are supporting transgenderism, because the transgender narrative specifically disassociates biological sex from gender. It insists that the authentic self is strictly a matter of inner feelings. And so kids down to kindergarten are being taught that their bodies are irrelevant to their identity. So the implication, again, is that the body doesn't matter, that matter does not matter. All that matters is a person's inner feelings or sense of self. So, well, in other words, if a person senses a disjunction between their mind and their body, the mind wins. But why? Why accept such a demeaning view of the body? That is radically dehumanizing. If our bodies don't have inherent value, then a key part of our human identity is being devalued. So the transgender narrative estranges people from their own body. And once again, you see how this opens up an opportunity for Christians to say what we're bringing is a much more positive, a much more humane,
right,
much more loving view. You may know there's an outspoken lesbian named Camille Paglia, and she has a quote that really sums up what's at stake. She basically says, look, nature has made male and female. That, you know, there's no doubt about that. You know, postmodernists who try to deny that are just denying nature. Nature made us heterosexual. They made us for reproduction. But then she said, but she herself is a lesbian. So she says, why not defy nature? Why not defy, as she puts it, defy nature's tyranny? And she says, fate, not God, has given us this body. And we have an absolute claim to our bodies and may do with them as we see fit. So that's really the heart of it. If purely blind material forces have given us this body, then why should we pay any attention to it? Why, it has no moral message.
Right.
It does not give us any clues to our identity. It does not inform our moral choices. By contrast, Christianity affirms that we live in a universe structured not by blind forces, but by the loving purposes of a personal creator. And we are called to live in harmony with that structure. So, you know, whereas critics say, well, Christianity is negative and oppressive, in reality, it affirms sexuality as part of our deep design, which speaks
yeah.
to God and the beauty of God's character.
Yeah, it goes right back again to the worldview issue. That's really good. Well, as we come to a close here, maybe you can end us on chapter 7, The Goddess of Choice is Dead, From Social Contract to Social Meltdown.
Yeah, this is going into some of the political and social implications of these issues, because people say, well, the sexual moral revolution is liberation, but in fact, you know, all of these issues we're talking about, it's expanding the coercive power of the state. And why is that? It's because it's destroying pre-political rights. So take abortion. In the past, the law recognized the right to life as a pre-political right that you have just because you're a member of the human race. The law doesn't create it. The law merely recognizes it. But the only way the state could legalize abortion was to deny the relevance of biology and declare that some humans are not persons. And so the state has claimed the authority to decide arbitrarily which humans qualify for the fundamental right not to be killed. So this is a huge increase in state power. Or take marriage. In the past, the state recognized marriage as a pre-political right based on the fact that humans are a sexually reproducing species. But the only way the law can treat same-sex couples the same as opposite couples is to deny the relevance of biology and declare marriage
right.
to be just an emotional commitment, which is what it did in the Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage. But the trouble is that there's endless varieties of emotional commitments, so the state has claimed the authority to decide arbitrarily which ones qualify as marriage. Or transgender. The only way the law can treat a trans woman, someone who's born male, the same as a biological woman is to deny the relevance of biology and to declare gender to be a matter of inner feelings. And so that's why the state is now passing laws and corporations are passing policies and schools are passing rules telling us who we must call he or she. And by the way, the next stage is parenthood. I've been reading some same-sex legal theorists who are saying in the past, the state recognized parenthood as a pre-existing reality. It's something that happens when a mother and father give birth to a child. The law recognized that as a prior fact. Only way the law can treat same-sex parents the same as opposite-sex parents is to deny the relevance of biology because, of course, in a same-sex couple, at least the child is not biologically related to at least one of the parents. And so, therefore, biological connection can no longer be the basis of parenthood. And the state will define who qualifies as a parent. And you will be a parent at the permission of the state. So notice in all of these cases, pre-political rights are being reduced to merely legal rights, and those are at the dispensation of the state. What the state gives, the state can take away. And so human rights are no longer inalienable.
And it goes back to that almost, again, the with the flying in the face of just biology. It's funny, though. It's like sometimes there are things that people just know, even though they may want to hold on to these particular views, intuitively they know, like I'm thinking of the Olympics or recently within mixed martial arts, there was a man that was a transgender woman and got in there and just knocked the stuffing out of a woman, you know, in the fights, or where the males, transgender male, will run in a female race and, you know, blow everybody's time away. I don't know. Things like that just seem to really intuitively, I think people just know that is it, there is a biological component and it can't be denied.
Yeah, and let's maybe we should end a little on what is the Christian view that helps that helps bolster that intuitive sense. What is the Christian view of the body? And I think it's fascinating that the Christian church has faced similar issues before, in that at the early church was surrounded by world-denying philosophies like Platonism and Gnosticism, which treated the material world as a place of death, decay, and destruction, and treated the body as a prison. That was the actual word people like Plato used, but the body was a prison that we want to escape from. In fact, in Gnosticism, there were several levels of deities, and this world was created by a low-level evil deity because no self-respecting God would get his hands dirty mucking about with matter. So in this context, Christianity was revolutionary. It taught that it was the highest God, the supreme deity, who created the material world. And what's more, he pronounced it very good. An even greater scandal at the time was the incarnation, the idea that God himself entered into the material world and took on a human body. The incarnation is the ultimate affirmation of the dignity of the body. And finally, at the end of time, God is not going to scrap the material world as if he made a mistake. He's going to renew it and restore it, creating a new heaven and new earth. And the Apostles' Creed affirms the resurrection of the body. So this is an astonishingly high view of the physical world. There's nothing like it in any other philosophy or religion. And that's why Love Thy Body, my new book, gives people the tools to go beyond a negative message, just, you know, it's wrong, it's sinful, don't do it, which is true, but incomplete,
right,
and gives them the tools to deploy positive arguments and to show how a biblical ethic is more appealing, more attractive, more compelling, more humane than any secular ethic.
Where can people go to get the book?
Well, you can get it just about anywhere books are sold. So you can get it from christianbook.com. You can get it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local Christian bookstore. It's available all those places.
Is there a website in that for people who are wanting to learn more about your work and follow what you're doing?
Yeah, there is one. This Nancy Piercy, nancypiercy.com, and you can look up my other books and get a sense of what I'm doing. And you can also look up the Piercy Report is a website run primarily by my husband, and that keeps people up to date on, it's kind of a news and worldview website. So nancypiercy.com and piercyreport.com are two websites that people can go to.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us and taking the time to go over your book with us. And we'll be praying for you, and we'll put the link up and encourage people to buy the book.
Wonderful. It was good talking with you.
You as well. Thanks again. God bless.
Okay, thank you.
All right, folks, that was Miss Nancy Piercy, and really good book. Really enjoy. Have not got to read the whole thing yet. I just got the book a few days ago, and I've been working my way through it, but I've seen a few talks and that by her on this, and I've really appreciated her work in the past. Brilliant thinker, brilliant scholar, and just a wonderful tools for the body of Christ. And so join us again. We're trying to do more of these podcasts and get more people on and have more guests. It's been a little busy. Quick health update with Melissa. She's still receiving some steroid treatments and that at the hospital, and I believe we'll be doing some blood plasma transfusions coming up. Those who know us and have kind of followed our story have seen some of the physical issues she's been dealing with the spinal cord, and that's been a fight, but she's doing okay. She's, you know, we're still got a long ways to go and still trying to figure out exactly what it is that's wrong physically, but working with some good doctors. My little girl's doing good. She's still in school and just growing like a weed and learning so much. So thank you, everybody, for your prayers for her. Still at Ratio Christi at Winthrop University. We've got some really good stuff coming up this semester. I believe it's February 27th. We're going to have Brian Henson, who works with Norm Geisler International Ministries, is going to be speaking, giving a talk on the evidence for the resurrection of Christ. You know, folks, again, this is at a secular university. For those who are not familiar with Ratio Christi, Latin for Reasons for Christ, we're an apologetics ministry on the campus and really seek to defend the Christian faith. We're doing some things that, you know, some of the ministries are not doing. Thankful for all the college ministries, don't get me wrong, that are on the campus. But, you know, we all have different parts. We all have different gifts, different talents, different things we can offer. And one of the things that Ratio Christi does is, I think, really well, is they focus on apologetics. And so maybe you're hearing this and you'd like to know if there's Ratio Christi by you. You can go to ratiochristi.org. Good chances are, if you're by a university or college, there very well could be a Ratio Christi there. You could look on our website to find out. And maybe you're the person that wants to start a Ratio Christi in your group. So be sure to check us out. If you go to our site on Ratio Christi, it's ratiochristi.org/people/thepalouse. You can learn more about who me and my wife are and kind of some of the stuff we're doing there at Winthrop, as well as in the pro-life work, as well as our podcast and that as well. So Clinton Wilcox is going to be with us next week, and I've done a lot of stuff with Clinton. He's been on the show several times, and so we're going to probably do another podcast and some video next week, as well as hit the campus and do some interviews. So be sure to join us for that. And like I say, we're going to try and get the Theology Matters show back a little more consistently, get some more guests, and really appreciate everybody tuning in and listening. Hopefully it was beneficial to you. We will be praying for you. Pray for us. And we hope to continue to glorify God through loving Him with all of our heart, with all of our soul, and with all of our mind. Until next time, God bless, folks.